Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure today to interview Ed Haslam, the author of a very important book, which develops some possible evidentiary connections between the milieu of the assassination of President Kennedy and not only a cancer epidemic, but quite possibly the development of AIDS as well. And if that sounds fantastic, well, stick around for the next 2 hours or so, give or take a half hour, and we're going to set forth the information that Ed presents in this very remarkable book. Ed, your book is called Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory.
Uh-huh.
It's published in soft cover by Wordsworth Press and copyright 1995. Welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Perhaps the place to begin in analyzing this very important and complex chain of information that you have presented is to begin with the city of New Orleans itself. New Orleans was an epicenter for many of the activities surrounding President Kennedy's assassination. Many Americans, myself included, generally associate New Orleans with jazz music, rhythm and blues, Mardi Gras, carnivals, partying. In fact, New Orleans is a very important American city from a political and economic standpoint. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Mardi Gras because that's a great metaphor to start with. If you look at a Mardi Gras float, you see all these people dressed up in masks and all this paper mache, but underneath it is a tractor and a steel truck moving along. And that's kind of the way New Orleans is. It's got a facade to it, and it's got a lot of strong structure underneath. The structure begins with the Mississippi River, which is the largest commercial waterway in the United States. It brings down coal and machinery and wheat and corn from the heartland of the United States and sends it out to other places on the globe, and it brings back in bananas and coffee and all kind of products from Central America. That river connection, the port, gives New Orleans its character and makes it a strategically very important point. It also means the historical connections, the trade connections with New Orleans, a lot of them are with the North because that's where their products came from. And therefore, you've got some interesting economic relationships, like a strong relationship between New Orleans and Boston that we'll be talking about in a little bit, that most people outside New Orleans would not really suspect just when they're thinking about it. The second thing about New Orleans is it's the northern port of the Caribbean and has a long history of commercial contacts and interest with places like Cuba and Haiti and Guatemala and Honduras. And it's actually closer to those places. It is closer to Guatemala City than it is to Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles. It's closer to Tegucigalpa, Honduras, than it is to New York or San Francisco. And it's closer to Caracas, Venezuela, than it is to Boston or Seattle. So New Orleans is really an access point for Central America. And in fact, as we'll be talking about in more detail later, the oligarchies and upper class of Latin America who don't have great medical services where they are all come to New Orleans for their medical service. So those are just a couple of the key characteristics that give New Orleans sort of a structural importance in the United States.
It is, again, by way of summing up, it is the America's commercial gateway. It's the northernmost port, I should say, in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And also it is the gateway to the Mississippi River, the largest commercial waterway in the United States. The main point, I think, to understand as we begin to develop our story is that New Orleans is one of the most important American cities in terms of this country's commercial and political relationships to Latin America. Latin America is among the most important commercial, political, and perhaps imperial areas with regard to the United States, and American business, American political life has long dominated that part of the world. Of course, we will be getting into the relationships between the Cuban political situation and New Orleans in the early 1960s a little later on in this discussion. But our listeners should remember that with regard to New Orleans, it is a very important political and economic connection between the United States and Latin America. You mentioned that New Orleans and Boston are quite closely connected. Could we briefly touch on that, Ed?
Sure. There's two ways to talk about it. One is there's a club in New Orleans called the Boston Club, which is the power center of people like bankers and stuff. And the whole history of the club was it's where people had some connection to Boston, whether that was through the United Fruit Company or through having gone to Harvard or through having gone to MIT or something, got together and shared their common experiences. It is probably the most prestigious and exclusive club. And, for example, I mean, just to give you an illustration, when Richard Nixon came to New Orleans in the early 1960s, he had a private lunch with Dr. Alton Ochsner that we'll be discussing later, and they had their lunch at the Boston Club. The other way of looking at it is through the United Fruit Company, and we'll be talking about that more when we get to Tulane, but the United Fruit Company was a Boston-based concern that grew bananas in Central America and brought them into New Orleans. And the chairman of the board of the United Fruit Company, Sam Zamuri, was from New Orleans.
And, of course, United Fruit is inextricably linked with the history of American intelligence and covert operations in Latin America, and we'll be coming to that in the later parts of the interviews. New Orleans, as a political and economic gateway to Latin America, would necessarily make New Orleans also a very strategic city with regard to American national security interests. Could you briefly discuss some of New Orleans' pedigrees as a national security epicenter?
Well, again, there's two ways of doing that. One is just the supply of weapons and supplies that go out in support of American military wherever it is going. A lot of those supplies are made in the heartland of the United States. They come down through New Orleans and they go out. The other way of looking at it is due to all the trade and commercial contacts that occur in New Orleans, the CIA set up shop down there so that every time a businessman came back from a trip on Latin America, they'd debrief him and they'd find out who he had been talking to and what was going on in the power structures in the various countries and what their attitudes were. And Clay Shaw, who is one of the people that we'll be discussing later, had 33 such reports filed with the CIA. And this was a common experience amongst businessmen in New Orleans who were involved in international trade.
And later on, as we get to some of the circumstances surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald's activities in New Orleans, we will be discussing New Orleans as a national security and intelligence epicenter as well. With regard to New Orleans' political and national security life, the Louisiana congressional and senatorial contingents had a lot to do with fostering both. Names like Edwin Abert, Hale Boggs, Russell Long, and Ellender. Could you tell us a little bit about these men's histories and how that relates to New Orleans politically and from a national security standpoint?
Well, sure, and the first point to make is in the early 1960s, Louisiana had the most powerful congressional delegation in America. And that congressional delegation was particularly focused on the issue of military and CIA budgets. The first person is F. Edward Hebert. He was the chairman of the Armed Services Committee for the U.S. House of Representatives. And as you know, budgets go from the House to the Senate. So when the CIA wanted to hide money from congressional scrutiny, Soviet scrutiny, and American scrutiny, it was Hebert's job to put it into the military budget in places where it was earmarked for the CIA. This made him an extremely powerful lawmaker, and of course meant he had a very close relationship with the CIA because he was preparing their budgets as well as the military. When the budget went over to the other side of the building, to the Senate, it went, of course, to the Senate Armed Services Committee, and there it went to Alan Ellender. Now, Alan Ellender was the senior senator when Huey P. Long first went to Washington as a senator. This guy was there by the 1960s for 40-something years, and he and Senator Russell from Georgia controlled the Senate Armed Services Committee. So between Hebert and Ellender, they pretty much controlled the American military budget and the CIA budget. The other two people who sound almost incidental to this are actually amazingly heavy hitters. One is Hale Boggs. Hale Boggs was, in 1963-64, the majority whip of the U.S. House of Representatives. That made him the third most powerful person in the House of Representatives. And he was also very close to LBJ and was considered LBJ's man in the House. The fourth player was Senator Russell Long. Senator Russell Long was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee that basically prepared the entire budget for the United States government, and he also sat on the Banking Committee. So with those four people, I mean, there were a total of seven in the delegation, but those four constitute an awful lot of power, and that's why it's so interesting that all these occurrences that we discuss, we'll be discussing here on the radio, but are in the book, happen to occur in these people's delegations.
And as, of course, we will be developing our discussion in the direction of President Kennedy's assassination, we should note that Hale Boggs and Russell Long both served on the Warren Commission.
Long was not on the Warren Commission.
Wasn't Long on the Warren Commission? I know Hale Boggs was.
Hale Boggs was, absolutely.
Oh, it was what? John Sherman Cooper from Kentucky. That's the fellow I'm thinking
of. And there was Russell, the guy that I was referencing.
Richard Russell, yes.
From Georgia.
Okay, excuse me, my mistake. With regard to New Orleans, with regard to its political and economic connections to Latin America, one of the most important names is Tulane University, one of the South's most prestigious universities, and also, like the city of New Orleans, not really particularly well understood outside of the South. In fact, Tulane, in addition to a fine educational institution, is a very powerful political and economic epicenter. United Fruit, a name we've already touched on, overlaps Tulane. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Tulane, if you went anywhere in Latin America and asked what was the American college that the children of the elite aspired to go to, it would be Tulane. It is very well respected in the area. And that goes back to the whole history of Tulane, which is a medical history. New Orleans, as we mentioned, is the northern port of the Caribbean, and back in the 1800s, 1830s in particular, as these ships came into New Orleans, they brought yellow fever and malaria with them, and the city of New Orleans was beset constantly by these epidemics and plagues and outbreaks in there, and Tulane was actually organized by a bunch of doctors for the purpose of, they didn't have enough doctors to get out and fight these tropical diseases. So the whole history of Tulane goes back to fighting tropical diseases. It was at Tulane that they discovered that malaria was spread by mosquitoes. And that discovery and some of the other discoveries that John Hopkins did down in Cuba made public health happen in Central America. I mean, Tulane helped them get rid of a lot of big diseases, and therefore the Latin Americans have a lot of respect for Tulane, and most of that respect is based on Tulane's role in fighting tropical diseases. Along with that, and with the trade, and with the bananas, comes the United Fruit Company. And the United Fruit Company was a very powerful and sinister company in Latin America during the 1800s, and they were crushing labor revolts and sinking competitorships and doing all kind of stuff in the late 1800s. By the time the mid-1900s come around, Sam Zamuri has risen from a pushcart salesman to the chairman of board of United Fruit Company.
How is his name spelled?
Zemurray.
Okay.
And if one is visiting New Orleans, one can go to Zamuri Gardens, which are the beautiful horticultural gardens that he developed. He was chairman of the board of Tulane University, as well as chairman of the board of the United Fruit Company, and his palatial house that he built on St. Charles Avenue right across from Audubon Park was given to Tulane University, and that's where the president of Tulane University actually lives, in Sam Zamuri's old house. The connections between United Fruit Company and the American intelligence community should be emphasized. Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles being the head of the Central Intelligence Agency and his brother being the Secretary of State, were major stockholders in the United Fruit Company. And so in 1954, when the democratically elected president of Guatemala, his name was Arbenz, decided to nationalize 250,000 acres of the United Fruit Company plantations so they could be operated for the benefit of the Guatemalan people rather than for the benefit of the Boston bankers. The American Central Intelligence Agency organized a coup d'etat and went in and replaced the Arbenz government. And this is really, at the height of the Cold War, this is one of the clear departures from where America, who was running around talking about democracy, actually overthrew a democratically elected government in order to protect some of their commercial interests.
Now, with regard to Tulane, we've touched on the heritage of that university developing in response to tropical diseases. Tulane has a very accomplished medical school and a prestigious medical school. One of the institutions that was operating, I believe, under the auspices of the medical school, correct me if I'm wrong, was the Delta Primate Research Center.
Well, at the moment, here in 1996, the largest facility in the United States for researching monkey viruses as well as other primate issues is the Delta Regional Primate Center. And Tulane is the host institution which manages that facility. The facility actually belongs to the U.S. government and the National Institute of Health. But it was put in New Orleans, or near New Orleans in Covington, so that both Tulane and LSU and some other universities in the region, Mississippi, et cetera, could have access to it. But Tulane is the managing facility on it. It's a $4 million a year budget out of the National Institute of Health. They've got 4,000 primates there on the facility.
We've discussed some of the national security connections, both to the city of New Orleans and in particular to Tulane University. One of the things that we will be coming back to later in the discussion is the issue of monkey viruses. And we should perhaps note that I believe it was in 1971, the man who became the director of the Delta Primate Center came there from Fort Detrick, Maryland.
Yeah, and that was coincidental with Nixon's declaring war on cancer. What he basically did was shut down some of the Army biowarfare operations and repackage them and relabel them as war on cancer operations. And that resulted in the transfer and replacement of several people. And Peter Girone, who is today the director of the Delta Regional Primate Center, was relocated from Fort Detrick, where he was one of their experts on airborne transmission of diseases. And we have, in the book, we cite where he attended meetings and gave papers with people like the Defense Nuclear Agency on the handling and care of primates. And that's one of the clear indications we have between the nuclear the radiation used in nuclear medicine and the monkey virus research that we'll be talking about.
We've been talking about the city of New Orleans as a political and economic entity, and that, of course, heavily overlaps Tulane University with many of the same connections and directions. And we were talking about the Tulane Medical School, its work on tropical diseases. One of the most important names in not only the history of Tulane Medical School, but the practice of medicine in New Orleans, and indeed the American medical community, and an individual we're going to be focusing on to a large extent, is Dr. Alton Ochsner, last name O-C-H-S-N-E-R. Can you tell us a little about his significance as a player in the American medical scene?
Okay. Alton Ochsner, first of all, his uncle, under whose wing he was brought into medicine, founded the American College of Surgeons and was chief of surgery at the University of Illinois, meaning he took care of the powerful and influential people from the Chicago area. That gave Ochsner a great leg up when he entered medicine, because his uncle, who was shepherding his professional career, had powerful contacts all over American medicine and close contacts with the power in Chicago, a lot of which was involved in the drug companies. At any rate, after only 1 year of teaching at the University of Wisconsin, Alton Ochsner was appointed chief of surgery of Tulane Medical School. He was, I believe, 29 years old at the time, maybe 30 years old. That was an outrageous act. I mean, that's like appointing a 28-year-old head of the FBI like they did with J. Edgar Hoover. It was a Alton Ostrom was given his own medical school, basically, to work with. And with that, he had a terrific head start in medicine. His uncle also arranged for him to bring blood transfusions to Europe for the first time. And we think of blood, we think of Switzerland and the Red Cross and everything else, but it was actually Alton Ochsner who brought the technique of blood transfusion to Switzerland. And he lit up the European medical sky with his introduction. So when he came back to the United States at the age of 28, he was a spectacular success. His uncle arranged for him to come down to Tulane. He won the position, and he started off as the chief of surgery, barely 30 years old. He quickly crossed swords with Louisiana Governor Huey P. Long and got both Tulane and himself personally thrown out of the largest hospital in America at the time, which was Charity Hospital in New Orleans, 1,732 beds. And that allowed Ostrom to spend a couple of years actually entrenching himself into the boards of medical associations around the country. He then, in the 1940s, started a clinic, which is today the enormous regional medical center with about $300 million a year in business, and that is located right outside of the city of New Orleans. It's called the Ochsner Clinic. It's on a par with the Mayo Clinic or any of the big regional MD Anderson in Houston. I mean, it's a big regional medical center, and it's named after Alton Ochsner, who founded it and ran it with a iron hand for years.
And Tulane Medical School and the Ochsner Clinic are very closely connected, are they not?
Well, today they are not, but they were at the time because when he started the clinic, he took the five department heads from Tulane University, and it was because of the ambiguity when they were doing things. I mean, for example, when Mary Sherman was brought to New Orleans, she was simultaneously made a partner at the Ochsner Clinic as well as given a professorship at Tulane University, both of which Alton Ochsner had control over. So he was able to bring in people from the outside because he could offer them two tickets instead of one.
Mary Sherman, by the way, we will be coming to in a big way later on in our story. She is the Mary in the title Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus.
One of the things, Dave, I'd like to emphasize about Alton Ochsner was that in 1949, he was president of the American Cancer Society. And that relationship is a very important relationship in understanding everything we're going to be talking about for the next hour and a half. On the board of the American Cancer Society with him was a fellow elected officer by the name of Wild Bill Donovan, who was in charge of American intelligence during World War II. So going back to the 1940s, Alton Ochsner was working with the United States Marine Corps, was working with the U.S. Public Service. He was consulting on malaria, which is a zoonotic monkey virus. A lot of people don't know this, but an entire division of Marines was taken out of action with malaria during World War II, and that's one of the things Ochsner was consulting with them on. So his relationship with people like Cordell Hull, who was the U.S. Secretary of State during World War II, and Wild Bill Donovan, who was in charge of American intelligence during World War II, and all these Navy admirals that he was consulting with, all goes back to the 1940s. As you look at his FBI file, as we'll get into in a little bit, you'll see that he has a long history of relationships with the U.S. military. He was a consultant for the U.S. Army. He was a consultant for the U.S. Air Force, which has its own monkey labs. He was had sensitive positions and assignments for the FBI and for other agencies that are not named in his file. So his medical prowess, from being, you know, really one of the big names in American medicine, president of the American Cancer Society, is all his public persona. Everybody acknowledges he's one of the most respected people in the history of the city of New Orleans. But there's another side to him that we will start to see in terms of his covert relationships and his secret assignments for the United States government.
Before we conclude this half-hour segment, we should also note that there is evidence of CIA involvement with some aspects of Tulane and perhaps Tulane Medical School.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the political pork and political power that was in New Orleans with Hebert and stuff. But where you find the most activity in that is in the area of pharmaceutical psychiatry. In other words, chemicals you put into the brain in order to knock people out, to make them do things, part of the mind control subject. There was a lot of activity in there, and I think, you know, Tulane was doing just what one would expect the college whose congressman was in charge of the CIA budget to do, which was to enjoy some of the benefits of that relationship.
We have been speaking with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory published in soft cover by the Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. We are going to come back with Ed Haslam, and we're going to begin developing some of these connections still further in the next half-hour segment of our broadcast. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.